This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal, and it is time for our weekly recap. Carrie Jr. the second. We have a little jingle right now.
Weekly recap.
It's pretty bad. We gotta work on that. We gotta come up with something better.
I like it being bad. I want it to stay being bad.
We need a bed of music underneath it too. You got to choose something that like we could sing along to.
See, you're acting for some additional production on that.
I think it's got to be top notch.
Okay. All right.
So this week on the recap, we are going to talk or look back at conversations from the week that included a discussion with Michael Powell, who writes for The Atlantic. He believes President Biden and upper middle class liberals are trying to gaslight poor Democrats into voting for the president, saying, hey, look at all the great things we've done for the economy. Mm-hmm. Don't mind that little nagging inflation problem. We also had a conversation this week with Andrew Bridge, who is a child's rights lawyer, who was also a survivor of the foster care system. He had a lot to say about how the system is incentivized to keep families apart. He had lots of ideas about how we could fix that. And we also talked about these protests on college campuses, students getting arrested for protesting the war in Gaza. We had a conversation about free speech and protest on campus, what the limits should look like. We're going to start with Michael Powell, President Biden, and inflation, Carrie.
Yes. Michael Powell, as you said, is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he says that the upper middle class left and Biden are kind of overlooking some of the concerns that Americans are really feeling. Biden has an election coming up in November, so there's a reason for him to want to promote some of the work he's doing. Unemployment is down. Inflation isn't as bad as it was at the peak of the pandemic, but Americans are feeling kind of concerned. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, food prices have risen 25% since 2019, so that's his full tenure. And, you know, a few different polls have said that his approval rating is below 40%. So mm-hmm. He's got some things to overcome, and this is his way of doing it, saying, hey, don't look at that.
Yeah.
Look at what we've
been
doing.
Look at the good. Don't pay attention to the bad. I think the one wild card people aren't necessarily accounting for yet, though, is the way labor is embracing this president after he embraced them during the auto strikes last year. They are really going to be energized this year to get what they are calling the greatest labor president in history reelected. And if you think they don't move votes inside the Democratic Party, you really have not been paying attention. I mean, they will have a huge effect on that turnout. The question is whether it'll be enough.
To be enough.
Yeah. So we're going to join this conversation at a point where we're talking about some of the president's legislation and how it actually helped Americans, despite also making inflation worse. The list is not short of things that President Biden has gotten accomplished that, in the long term at least, would really help middle and working class Americans. So let's just talk about a couple of them. The ARPA funds that states have gotten. I mean, in some cases, billions of dollars that have flowed into states to do all kinds of things that they wouldn't have been able to afford on their own. The Infrastructure and Jobs Act. The expansion, again, of the child tax credit, which when I talk with anti-poverty advocates, they now speak in terms of eliminating child poverty in America. That seems within reach for them now because of the things that President Biden has done. So with a resume like that, you would think this should be a pretty easy case to make. I want to talk about why those things have maybe enhanced or exacerbated the problem with inflation, and whether the message that says, hey, hang on, hang in there, of inflation is something that goes up and down. These are permanent things that we've put in place that will make life better for the base of the party?
I mean, look, that's a great point, right? I mean, the point of writing my piece was not to argue that there's no, you know, no accomplishment, that Biden can point to no accomplishments. Clearly he can. And unemployment is way down, right? I mean, there's been wage growth for the first time in quite a while. It's run again ahead of official inflation, not ahead of all inflationary costs, but nonetheless, that's an accomplishment. There's more unionization. I mean, there's a number of things that, some of them directly attributable to Biden, obviously things like unionization, more part of the zeitgeist or the environment. And those things are things you can point to. One of the problems he confronts, and this isn't unique at all to Biden, is that with some of the infrastructure programs you pointed to, I mean, those were real accomplishments. He got those through, as we know, a deeply polarized Congress. But the distance between cup and lip on those projects, in other words, between getting the okay, you know, we can do whatever it is, you know, alternative energy, we can do highways, we can do wind farm, all that kind of stuff takes a very long time. And there's a striking number of those projects that are still, you know, not in the ground, right? I mean, there's not even construction going on yet. That, again, is not unusual. I mean, it cuts across parties. One could certainly argue that it points to the need for regulatory reform, but that's, you know, those are kind of, well, not, those are different issues, right? So, I mean, but that is part of that problem. So, sure, you've passed that stuff, but will, you know, has it translated into jobs immediately? Again, you could argue, well, this is, you know, this is unfair. God is unfair, right? I mean, you know, that this stuff may go up in a year or two. And if his opponent, Trump, wins, then, you know, people say, oh, yeah, well, you know, Trump was president, that thing happened. But the point is that distance between cup and lip, that's why things like inflation and, frankly, in fairness to Biden, things like employment are so important, because that's immediate. Yeah. I mean, that's what you're experiencing in your daily, the daily reality of your life.
Yeah. So let's talk about jobs, which I didn't put on that list and probably should have, because it's absolutely among the president's most dramatic accomplishments is the job growth. And it's been surprisingly robust in the last few months, especially. Why hasn't the job picture done more to not alleviate inflation, but alleviate the idea that inflation is such a problem? I mean, you know, the labor market, you know, is better right now than I can remember in maybe the last decade in terms of the jobs that are available, jobs that pay really good money and have benefits and all of those things. How come that is not making more people feel better about inflation? Talk about the relationship between those two things.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And look, some of this may be like kind of a delayed echo effect, right? So, and that's certainly one of the fervent hopes of the Biden administration, of his campaign, is that as this, you know, as kind of month after month, the employment rate remains low and frankly surprises a lot of people, because I think when everyone thought when interest rates went up that you were going to see a drop in, you know, monthly job creation. And so far you haven't seen that. So it could be that they can point to a real sweet spot, and that by the time we come to the fall, again, that kind of daily reality of people's lives will start to reflect that, right? That you're, well, you know, there's a lot, costs may be high, but, you know, I've got a job, my kid's got a job, my cousin has a job, and by the way, wage increase, you know, there are wage increases that are running at least near the rate of inflation. And as we know, you know, for a long time, wages, particularly at the lower end, were very depressed. Yeah. And that is less so the case now. So that's certainly something they can point to. I mean, look, you also have there's a non-economic reality, which is that Biden also needs to sell that, right? I mean, he needs to sell that reality. And there I think there's an open question, right? I mean, he's not putting aside all, any issue of, his mental capability. I mean, let's assume that's all fine. He's an older man, and it's hard to get out on that kind of the hustings in the way that a Obama or a Bill Clinton could have, and just kind of go up and down, the country saying, this is working, this is working, you're working, you've got jobs, you've got salaries. And I think that's one of that kind of the sell job looms as a, I think a big question mark for the president.
Yeah. In your article, you get pretty deeply into, the economic side of all this and the way the economy works. One of the things that's kind of occurred to me over the last 4 years, and especially in the last few, is that maybe some of this is about a shift in the economy. In other words, that the rules that would apply from past instances of this kind of government spending and this kind of inflation are somehow being rewritten by the current economy and dynamics that didn't exist before. Is that something that we ought to be kind of thinking about?
I'm sorry. So, what do you mean? I'm not quite clear.
So, in other words, why, given all of the great things that are happening in the economy, does inflation persist the way it does? Is something different that is fueling inflation that maybe we hadn't dealt with before, and that we don't quite understand how to deal with?
That may be, but I mean, I think on the other hand, it's not. I mean, look, in fairness to, whoever was the president at the time, when you go through something like a plague, mm-hmm. right? I mean, a worldwide plague in which millions upon millions of people are dying. You've got vast dislocations in your economy. All mm-hmm. of a sudden, you've got, tens of millions of people working at home. You've got others working in fear of their lives. And you're trying to keep those families afloat, or I shouldn't say just families, keep people afloat financially at that time. You're pumping, that is the government is pumping a lot of money into the economy. It happened under Trump. It absolutely continued under Biden. And I think most economists, and frankly, of less moment, so do I, see that as an incredibly important decision that kept families from going under. Mm-hmm. And so that was an unintended, unexpected thing that government had to do. It created inflationary inflation in the economy. And for a while there, it created a scary amount of inflation. So that I'm not sure. I mean,
So this may just be the way it goes. This may just be the way it works.
This may be the way it goes. And look, inflation has come down. Even those who take, such as myself, a grimmer view of inflation. I mean, it's running now, if you were to factor in all of these other things, interest rates, that kind of stuff, maybe 7%, 8%, it's not running at 25, 30%.
Right.
So it has come down. There's every reason to expect that it probably will continue to come down, though I should note in the last month it kind of jogged up again a little bit.
It did, yeah.
Right. So, you know, I'm sure that's just, that's worrisome for the administration. But anyway, so there's all of these. I mean, there were these that, you know, kind of terrible word, but this was a massive exogenous event, something that came in from the outside. It was like the financial equivalent of an asteroid hitting. and I don't, you know, so I think that we, any president could fairly say, wait a minute, you know, like I didn't create 20% inflation because I was simply, you know, writing wild checks to people.
Right, right. This happened for reasons I couldn't control. You know, it also occurs to me that, and I would love you to kind of quickly talk about your kind of outlook for this thing. I mean, when you balance the inflationary side against the effects, the long-term effects of the things that the president has gotten done, you know, barring other outside unexpected events, things should get better for working class and middle class people under those policies. I mean, is it your estimation that would happen? That as inflation subsides, these other things would take hold and make things opportunity and, you know, wealth accumulation and growth better.
Yes.
Yeah.
In a word, I mean, I think that is, you know, as I say, there is this, you know, this no doubt frustrating if you're in federal government, and certainly frustrating for those outside of federal government, this time lag between when these things are passed. So, mm-hmm. you know, you see a big, you know, I mean, these big bills were passed in 21, 22. And well, why isn't it, you know, I don't feel it out there. Well, in part that is, I mean, you could fairly argue that in some cases, perhaps the federal government should be working harder to cut through red tape, but it also just takes a long time to do this stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think there's a reasonable expectation that if, the President Biden gets a second term, that by 2025, 2026, you're starting to see some of this stuff going into the ground. Then it's going to be up to him to remind people, hey, that's me. You know, that's
that,
the Democrats
right.
that did that for you.
Yeah.
And that's a whole different, you know, that's a different case. But it's, if he were running in 2026, he probably could point to, you know, you outside of Nashville, you're working in this factory because mm-hmm. I got a bill passed in 2022 that did that. He can't do that yet.
Yeah, yeah. That was Michael Powell, the staff writer for The Atlantic. Coming up, we're going to revisit a conversation about how complicated and harmful the foster care system in this country can be. Welcome back to Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, joined by Carey Jr. II. Next up, we're going to talk about the foster care system in America. And we're going to talk about it with somebody who knows it from two ends. One, as a lawyer who advocates for children in the system. The other is as a member, a ward of the foster care system. Andrew Bridge has seen both sides and is now an advocate for real change.
That's right. He spent 11 years in the foster care system. I mean, there's not much more I can add to that. I think this snippet will really speak to his story because he tells really vivid experience of what it was like for him to go through it, to understand the issues and to come out on the other side fighting for the kids.
Yeah. So here's a snippet of our conversation with Andrew Bridge. So you spent 11 years in the foster care system, but you're also a Fulbright scholar and a graduate of Harvard Law, and you had a mother who was diagnosed as schizophrenic. That is a very broad spectrum of experience, and I think it speaks directly to some of the things that you write and speak about. But let's start there. Tell us about your family. Tell us about your parents, and tell us how you ended up in the foster care system.
Well, I'm the son of what was a single mom. My father, he left my mom very shortly after I was after they had me, my mom didn't go to college. She didn't go to graduate from high school. She went to beauty school, and as most single moms, she struggled, and so. She planned out our future with me at her side. I watched her descend into schizophrenia when I was 6 years old. Mm. So our life went from what was a really pretty stable environment of an apartment and a bedroom to a motel in North Hollywood where we were venturing out at night, hunting for food from dumpsters. And one day in the early morning, a squad car rolled up alongside me, asked me if my name was Andrew, and literally pulled me from my mom's arms and put me in a place called McLaren Hall, which was in Los Angeles County. It was an abandoned polio hospital with about 300 kids in it. Mm. I stayed in foster care for the rest of my childhood. I was never adopted, never returned to mom. And so what happened to me is what we really don't want to ever have happen to a kid, and what I work for as an adult not to happen to children, is that when we take kids from their families, not return them back, not have them be adopted, and essentially have them raised by the state.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's go back to that moment when a squad car pulls up and rolls down the window and asks you if your name is Andrew, and you say yes, and they take you from your mother. I mean, the range of emotions, I think, in that moment, and the fear that you must have felt. Talk to us about what was going through your mind at that moment.
Well, you know, I have to say, I think it was probably the most frightening moment of my life, one that happened the week before my seventh birthday. And it's why, you know, my second book is called The Child Catcher. Mm-hmm. That's what it felt like. Mm-hmm. It felt like a kidnapping. No one explained who they were. No one explained where my mom was going to be. No one explained how she would know to find me. No one explained how I would find her. No one explained the system that I was in. So I was put into a social worker's car, and with in an hour and a half, everything that I knew about my life, from the clothes that I was wearing to where I was going to school or had been going to school, to most importantly, my mom, were gone. Mm-hmm. And did not come back.
And the effort here made by the system, I mean, for lack of a better word, was supposed to save you, correct? I mean, in their eyes, they were helping you. They were taking you from what they saw as a dangerous situation and supposedly sending you to something better. Do you feel like that's what happened?
That's all correct. My mom, I just want to be clear, my mom never hurt me. My mom was suffering terribly, but she never hurt me. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. From that day that I was taken by Los Angeles County into care, all that any social worker, judge, or lawyer had to ask that little boy was, Andy, do you have family? Mm. And if they had asked that, I would have said that I had a grandmother, a great uncle, a great aunt, an uncle, and three cousins on my mom's side, and there were more on my dad's side.
Yeah.
Had someone asked that question, I would have gone home and not spent the next 11 years in foster care.
Yeah.
That was the greatest failing of foster care for me, and the failing that a lot of children face today.
Yeah.
Not being returned to their families.
Well, and I think that's really the point of a lot of your work, is that this is the way, again, the system tends to work. It tends to attempt to rescue children from situations that that are deemed inappropriate or dangerous. But it doesn't take into account what's possible, within the reach of that child's own own family or environment, that it breaks an important tie with who you are and where you're from.
That's exactly right. And I think it's very important for folks to understand, for people to understand, that the vast majority of kids who enter foster care, somewhere around 60 to 70%, they don't enter care because they've been abused. Mm-hmm. They don't enter care because they've been physically hurt. They enter care because their parents and family are poor. Mm-hmm. And with that in mind, we need to look at this system and say, is this the best way to deal with and respond to the needs of families because they're poor? Should we be taking children away from families because they have a home that isn't the cleanest, because they have to leave a child alone in order to work, because they confront all of those things that wealthier families don't confront and don't really have to think about? Mm-hmm. That's the thing that we need to look at. And I think at its core, what it comes down to is respecting these families and understanding their value and their worth.
So if that had happened in your case, the way that you just described, respecting the value and worth of your family, what would have been a reasonable alternative? Or do you think that you didn't really need an alternative to living with your mom? Were they wrong about how they assessed what was happening to you?
Well, I'd say, first of all, what would have happened is I would have been sent to live with my grandmother. My grandmother lived in Chicago. I'd actually lived with my grandmother for a little while. My grandmother knew me. She loved me. She cared about me. And I could have gone to live with her. And the thing that would have happened is once I lived with my grandmother would have been able to assess how her daughter should interact with me, mm-hmm. when her daughter was doing well, when her daughter wasn't, what her daughter needed, and what would make that relationship between her grandchild and her daughter one that still had love in it, one that still had a connection. That would have made the difference.
Yeah. And was the system wrong about your mom? I mean, you talked about her struggles with mental health. Yeah. Was she unable to care for you? Was she permanently unable to care for you? Were they right in the way they assessed this?
So I get asked that question, and I think the first thing is to just what does care for mean? Could my mom have held her own apartment, got me ready for school, seen to that I was fed, got me home from school all on her own? No, she couldn't have done that. But there's another part of caring. There's a part called love. Hmm. Did my mom love me? Yes. So that mean that she needed to be barred from my life, that she needed to only have 15-minute phone calls that were monitored once a week or 1 hour a visit monthly? Hmm. No, my mom could have been allowed in my life so much more. And I think that's the thing, and the work that I do in child welfare today is to understand that parents have so many things to offer and to wrap our heads around the idea that failures and love can, in fact, exist side by side.
Yeah.
And there are very few parents who have absolutely nothing to offer their children. Parents love their children and their children love them. Ask a foster child today, where do you want to go? What do you want to have happen? And inevitably, the first thing they will say is, I want to go home. Mm. I want to go back to mom. I want to go back to dad.
Well, and if you think about it, I mean, any of us who are parents will admit to the complication of the definition of that word and that experience, right? There are things that as a parent you do that you're like, man, I am nailing that. I am putting it over the fence in that way. But then there are other things that you're like, oh my goodness, I'm really not getting this right, and I can't get this right. I can't figure this part out. But the reality is about the struggle, right? It is about the tension between those two things and your constant effort to try to do more of one than the other. There's nobody who is 100% on one side or the other of it.
I think that's so true, and I think that's what foster care struggles with, is to recognize that parents are struggling, and parents may never get some parts of it right. But the point is there's love between that child, there's an attachment, and above all, we want to keep that attachment there. We want to keep it intact. We don't want it suddenly to go missing, that suddenly a child feels that they're orphaned, feels that they're lost in a system that doesn't really care about them. And I will say that children know that a system doesn't care about their mother or their father or their families. Mm. And when a child knows that, the first thing they think is, if you don't care about the people that are most important to me, how am I to believe that you actually care about what happens to me?
Wow.
That's the thing.
Yeah. So you were talking about the system being designed to kind of react this way to situations in which it intervenes, and that in general it reacts this way. Let's talk about a little about why this is a common experience, and why hasn't the system figured out a better way to quote unquote help people who are in the situation?
You know, that's a complicated question. I think there are lots of ways to answer. Some folks would answer that it's money. The way foster care departments are paid, they're paid on the basis of the number of kids they take and how long they keep them. That's a terrible set of incentives.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something deeper, and there's something I remember as a kid, and something I know when I talk to kids who I've represented and helped in the foster care system. And that is a failure to fundamentally respect the families that they came from. You know, overwhelmingly, foster care departments call them the Department of Children and Family Services. It's that service to family part that's missing.
Hmm.
That willingness to sit down with a mom and say, you're having trouble finding a job. Let's help you get there. You're having trouble finding an apartment. Let's help you get there. And, you know, I serve on the Arizona Foster Care Review Board, and the number of times that I see mom will find a job, mom will find an apartment, and what she's given is a list that goes on, and there are backlogs on it. And all the while, the timeline for terminating her rights keeps ticking away. And so we end up, and often in this system, are things called children called legal orphans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we've terminated parental rights. They don't have an adoptive family. They don't have a guardian. They're not going back home. They literally have no one.
And what happens then? I mean, what's the end of that story?
So the end of that is reaching 18 and aging out.
Mm-hmm.
The end of that is entering the world as an 18-year-old, which I think everyone knows, everyone that has ever parented a child, that is not grown up.
No.
May look grown up on the outside, definitely not on the inside. And what happens is that 18-year-old enters the world alone and is expected to find a job, expected to make it through college and school, expected to find a place to live on their own. And they've not been given the things that allow them to do that. And they don't have the sports that other kids have. You know, an 18-year-old who leaves a very nice family, leaves a family where they've grown up in. You know, if they stumble, mm-hmm. if they don't stay at their job, maybe they fall out of school, whatever they do, that family's there for them. That family will help them. And the thing that's lacking in foster children's lives is they don't have that. They don't have that hand that reaches out and says, "When you stumble, I will catch you."
And it's not if, it's when, right?
It's when.
I mean, all of us have some moments where we can't get it right. We can't figure it out.
We know this as parents, but we also know this is just human beings. There are times we just don't get it right. And the number of times that we've gone ahead and we've relied on someone, we've had someone there, someone we could call, someone to help us out. And that's what's missing.
That was Andrew Bridge, a child's rights lawyer and advocate for foster children. We're going to take a quick break, and coming up, we're going to hear a conversation about the pro-Palestinian protests on college campuses and the response to them. We're back with Created Equal and our weekly recap show. Carrie, we talked earlier this week mm-hmm. about these massive, in some cases, protests that are taking place on college campuses, pro-Palestinian protests, and the response that college presidents have had to them. In some cases, calling the police in to disband them, and we saw some violent confrontations mm-hmm. between police and the demonstrators.
Yeah, there were dozens of protesters arrested over this past week at different institutions. Talking about Columbia, we're talking about NYU, a few other campuses too. There were encampments and arrests across the country, like Emory, Yale. I already said Columbia. So yeah, there's been pretty prevalent demonstrations going on, and the response that the administrations have had have kind of come under some scrutiny. And I know Columbia released a statement kind of outlining exactly what their guidelines are and when they are going to call enforcements in for the encampments and for occupying spaces and disrupting schools. So it's caused a lot of conversation around protesting the rights of free speech, and I imagine y'all got into all of that.
Yeah, and academic freedom is one of the other things at stake here, this idea of what is a university or college for. It's supposed to be for inquiry. It's supposed to be for curiosity and dialogue. Part of that dialogue has always been about protest and disruption. And this is a different era than the 1960s, of course. But some of what we're seeing reminds us of the 60s and the struggles we had defining the limits of that academic freedom and free speech. So we talked with Dr. Sophia Rosenfeld of the University of Pennsylvania, who wrote a really interesting piece in the New York Times about what she's learning from her students. And then Shika Dalmia, who runs a Substack called The Unpopulist, joined us. She is someone who studies the creep of authoritarian instincts in American culture. So I want to start with what happened last night. The Columbia encampment was dismantled. The New York Police Department forcibly removed students who were occupying Hamilton Hall, a place that has been a site of protest more than once. If we go back to the 60s, there were anti-war protests there. There was also student protests to end South African apartheid there in the era when I was in school at the University of Michigan. I want to get both of your reactions to what we saw, what we were able to see of what happened last night. Dr. Rosenfeld, I'll start with you.
Okay, sure. Well, I will say that it's been extremely disturbing all week to see pictures of police action, some of it really rather brutal police action, places like Indiana, Texas, where the police seem heavily militarized and really a show of force that's disproportionate to what's going on, to my mind. That included Columbia on the first clearing of the encampments. Last night, there was a slightly different sense about what happened, I think, because it was the occupation of a building happened in a slightly different fashion. But I will say that I agree with the basic premise we're talking about here, which is that students in general need to have a very wide latitude for speech on campuses. That doesn't mean anything goes at all. It doesn't mean that, you know, you can advocate violence, that you can engage in violence. There are restrictions about time, place, and manner. There also should be restrictions about certain kinds of really noxious hate speech. But that said, it's essential to the academic mission of universities that students be given a really big space for talking about what they want to talk about. Same for faculty. I would refer to academic freedom as much as the First Amendment here. So what we saw last night was indeed disturbing.
Shika, one of the things that has been going through my mind all week is what we saw in, I believe it was 2017, in Charlottesville near the University of Virginia, when, you know, a torch-bearing rabble of right-wing protesters marched through the streets with their lit torches and chanting very offensive phrases about their sense of what was happening, what was changing in America. And the response to that, there was very little police presence at that march. And they certainly didn't engage with those protesters in the way that we're seeing people or police engage with the protesters here. Obviously, nothing is kind of an apples to apples comparison. There were lots of differences, but that's been going through my mind all week, that this, there's something different about this than we often see when students or groups of people who believe something different than what these protesters are talking about are engaged in similar behavior.
Yeah. You know, what's been going through my mind, Stephen, watching these protests unfold over the entire country, campuses in the whole country, is that we are actually in some ways seeing the reenactment of Charlottesville, which I think I take your point. I mean, there is something similar there. But actually the civil rights era, where there was a clear divide in how southern states were handling protests by Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders with violence and, the full force of law enforcement, and northern states. And setting aside Colombia for a second, for a minute, I'll come to it. But in the South, there has been an extremely disturbing authoritarian response to the protests. I mean, Governor Abbott didn't waste a single moment to bring in riot police to deal with absolutely peaceful protests. Not just that, they savaged photojournalists and video journalists and other media, and very, very violently disbanded those protesters. Things have been a little bit different. I mean, in Washington University, I was watching some footage last night of police savaging a university professor, beating him, and then dragging his limp body into a van. But I think in northern campuses, setting aside Columbia, there has been a variety of responses. And the ones that have worked, I think there have been a few instances where this has been handled well. I think Princeton has been one, Johns Hopkins has been one, where there were very clear rules established in advance that have been consistently enforced in a viewpoint-neutral way. So, for instance, in Princeton, the president issued a statement saying that even though technically some encampments and some forms of expression might be a violation of time, place, and manner restrictions that Sophia was talking about, they would still tolerate them so long as they didn't morph into violence, intimidation, and harassment of Jewish students on campus. That's not how Columbia has handled the situation. Columbia President Shafiq, I hate to say this, but she has made a complete mess of the situation. She has been too eager to appease congressional critics who are accusing Columbia of anti-Semitism to react in a completely ham-handed way to the protests. So she went in a congressional hearing, and because she had learned from the example of the previous hearing with University of Pennsylvania, MIT, and Harvard presidents, where they got accused of anti-Semitism, she came out very hard against the protesters and assured congressional leaders that she was going to crack down on these protests. And the next day she called in the riot police, or if not the riot police, but NYPD. And of course, that just inflamed the situation and caused more encampments and more protests from students. And yesterday she had to then resort to the ultimate action and bring in the NYPD again and arrest and suspend. And, things got kind of ugly.
Dr. Rosenfeld, can you talk about what's different, or I guess what's changed that we may be witnessing now that kind of separates what's going on here from those eras, and how our notions, especially on college campuses, about speech and what's acceptable speech seem to have changed as well?
Yes, sure. I think there are two major factors we can point to that really make this a little different. And the point of comparison for me wouldn't really be Charlottesville, a place I used to live, so I know very intimately, because those people were not community members and they were not students. It was a kind of outside infiltration of the city. These are much more, these demonstrations really come up from the bottom, which is to say they really percolated up from students. and community people have joined in, but they're not outside forces arriving in these spaces. They're really battles within universities.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, I think you're right. They really evoke more something like the 60s and the Vietnam War protests, when a divided society saw its divisions play out on campuses too. The my era, which is clearly yours too, of the anti-apartheid in South Africa demonstrations of the late 80s and early 90s, for instance, I think were different in a way and did not provoke this kind of violence because there was some more general consensus that the students were on the right side.
Hmm.
In this moment, several things have shifted. One, the battle is between who's the real defender of free speech has been swinging wildly between the right and the left over the last few years. That's an important factor in all this, a sense of who free speech really benefits, the powerful or the distressed and the subjugated. And the other thing that I think has really shifted is that this particular battle is playing out at a moment when we're in a deeply polarized political environment. It's playing out in the year of an election of a president that's an extremely fraught election. It's playing out in the era of social media, where much of the demonstrators sometimes have demands that are specific to universities, but sometimes it's much more a sort of need to be seen,
yeah,
which contributes to a larger global effort to shift opinion about Israel and Gaza. In that sense, these are very tough battles. They are pitting people on opposing political sides. They're being weaponized by everybody in sight, from politicians to people meet in the media looking for clicks.
Mm-hmm.
They are pitting certain values against each other, an important sense of the necessity of calling attention to the atrocity of what's happening in Gaza. All of this is playing out.
That was our conversation with Dr. Sophia Rosenfeld of the University of Pennsylvania and Shika Dalmia of the Substack Unpopulist, The Unpopulist, about the protests on college campuses this week. That does it for our weekly recap, Carrie.
Do you feel any different about the protests that you see now and compare them to the ones that happened in the past? Is there any takeaways that you feel like highlight the similarities, differences? I'm curious.
So I felt like the protests we're seeing right now are way more peaceful than the ones that were taking place on college campuses when I was a student in the late 1980s and early 90s. That was another era of pretty significant protests. Those weren't violent protests either, but the ones now seem very docile and tame by comparison. And of course, they don't compare at all to the ones in the 1960s. It seems that the college presidents here are reacting to the disruption of the protest, which I think is an overreaction, right? I mean, the whole point of protest is disruption. I think because it's happening on a college campus, that disruption is an invitation to dialogue. It is an invitation to an exchange of ideas. And I'd rather see those presidents lean into that than the idea of a crackdown. I don't understand, in fact, why they see the need to have control over these students and their speech.
I do imagine if they do last for a long time and continue disruption, it then contradicts with the primary mission of those institutions, which is to conduct courses and classrooms. And I don't know that that specific situation is the best place to have a dialogue. It might be a more controlled setting. So at some point, you have to get past the disruption and get to the dialogue. So I'm not saying that one way is they shouldn't be protesting, but I don't know that policing and enforcing specific guidelines on how you're going to respond to them is, I don't know if that's an overreach. I feel like you got to let them know what your rules are, and you got to stick to your rules.
And, to some extent, protest is about breaking the rules.
That's fair.
That's the point.
That's fair.
Look, you've got to be prepared to meet the consequences for breaking those rules.
Mm.
But I also think the people who are enforcing the rules should have
a
broader sense about what is going on than just law and order. This is not just about rules and rule breaking. It is about a message and, again, an invitation to dialogue about a really really serious subject in this case, this war that Israel is raging in Gaza, and the fact that so many people in this country feel like that war is unjust, mm-hmm. And that people are you know, being brutalized as a result. I think the reactionary response of the crackdown completely misses the point of the message. That'll do it for us on Created Equal. Be sure to listen to our recent episodes at WDET.org, and we would love if you would subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio editing is done by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.